question, John. K2LIW in the tech net.
And to extend, can I make an announcement?
Okay. Briefly, go ahead with your announcement.
This is November 2, X-ray Juliet November. I enjoyed the TechNet for a long period of time. And I was thinking, how nice would that be if the TechNet will become a worldwide event for thousands of ham radio operators around the world. And there was a time last year when I spoke to the president of this club, and I said that I want to make it $1,000 contribution towards the technology that would allow to do that. Fortunately, there is not a need for me to make that donation to the club, as ICOM launched the special program, which will allow you to transmit the way that you transmit right now, in addition to the store. Here's the point. Let me talk.
Fire drop dead.
From April 25, 2011 to May 9, 2011, if the club purchased direct from ICOM of America, D-Star repeater worth of $3,000, then ICOM will refund 100% of this money. So the repeater, which contains controller, RF module, gateway software, will be for free for the club. And the requirement is that within 90 days, the repeater will become operational. That's all. And I believe the club qualifies for it for the chance. Back to you, and to XJ.
Current internet connections, IRLP and Echolink, there are people we know of in quite a number of countries that have from time to time listened to the TechNet. And the offer that you've gotten from ICOM does sound attractive. And let's see how that works out. I don't quite understand all the details yet, but I guess I'll, in the coming days and weeks, be finding out more about that. Wesley, it sounds like maybe you found an attractive offer.
This is the offer to the club, and it's $3,000 that will be refunded 100% for the club.
K2YL.
Go ahead, Bernie.
Good evening, Dick in the net. Wesley, I think the appropriate forum for this would be to bring this up at a club committee meeting, because I believe to make capital investment, you need first the board meeting to approve it, and then I believe something of this magnitude would have to go to general voting. I'd have to read the bylaws again, but basically you need to bring this up to the bring this up to the board meeting. And assuming we can get frequency coordination, the biggest challenge is going to be frequency coordination. We're pretty jammed up here in the New York area. But yeah, if you can work this out, make a presentation, I think the club will go for it.
Okay. This is into XGM. This is a special program for America by ICOM of America. I have sent a copy of that program to Breach and to IDX. And it's up to the club. So I already brought that to the attention of the club. If the club doesn't have to spend a dime for that repeater, I believe that's a very good program. And the club would definitely benefit from that. What do you think about it, Dick? And there is it.
K2YL again.
Go ahead, Bernie.
essentially the point is that IBX is not a board member. So you can bring it up to all the rank and file members you want, but until you present it to the board and get them to vote up or down on it, somebody has to champion this. The repeater committee is basically Eric and Andy would be the two people you would need to sway their opinion, because that's who the board's going to go ask. But that would be the rank and file that you would need to have, and then you need the board to approve the funds.
Probably be to ZDX with some comments.
Thank you for your question. ZDX pick up.
Vic should really be telling me to pick up. I saw that thing for the icon. We're not eligible because nobody in New York City area is eligible. The only place in New York vicinity is upstate New York. Basically, you pay $3,000 for the repeater. You put the repeater within 90 days installed and do this and that, and they give you back the $3,000. But if you look carefully, it gives you the state, and nowhere in New York City area or New Jersey area is eligible for that. K2RIW, WBZX.
Thank you for the additional information, Gerald. We'll eventually get to the bottom of all this and find out whether or not it is an offer that we can respond to and how much value it has to the club. I'm still kind of glad that Wesley is attempting to do this, and we'll find out how well it's going to work. John, KC2WGB, go right ahead with your question.
Dick, I didn't have a question. It was just my request for you to comment on the Times article, I guess, after Mel, if you have time.
Yes, I will. We do promise that at 9 o'clock, and we're a little bit beyond 9 o'clock, that Mel will be going to his mailbag, and right after that, we'll get into the discussion of this beautiful article in last Sunday's New York Times Sunday Magazine section. Let's see, it's the April 17th issue. This beautiful seven-page or so article on the subject of Do Cell Phones Cause Brain Cancer? To RF enthusiastic people, that's an interesting subject. But mailbag first, because these younger people who are getting their license, I have to get their beauty sleep. K2KEY, K2RIW, you got it, Mel?
2EO, Dick.
Yeah, I forgot about you, Rich. Stand by a second, Mel. Go ahead with your comment, Rich.
Dick, I checked in late. I know we're past 9 o'clock. I have a question on grounding as far as lightning, you know, the antennas I put up last year. I wonder, will you do this after the mailbag, or would you rather I hold it over till next week? Your choice.
Let's see how the mailbag goes, and maybe we'll take that question now, Rich. K2KEY, go ahead for the mailbag.
K2YY Mobile.
Okay, Joe is also recognized. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. All right, we'll pick up everybody, I'm sure. All right, I'm just looking through, you know, trying to find questions that basically, I could say, young people getting involved in this hobby, even some older people that are getting involved in this hobby. Here's an interesting one. This is about equipment, I guess, apropos to something that Rich brought up. Equipment cables and keeping them orderly. He writes here, how do you keep all those power RF cables straight and accessible in the back of the equipment? Everything, as I added equipment over the last year, everything is really tangled up. I have the impossible task of determining what goes where by trying to bend over the back of my desk. I also have added a shelf where I have little other odds and ends, and troubleshooting and coming up aware of whatever is going on here has become a mess. And sometimes I think it's even hazardous reaching around in the back of this rat's nest. What do you suggest to do to organize things? How do you guys do it? Go ahead.
I got a comment for that one, Dick.
Go ahead, John.
Mel, very simple device made by Pandut. It's a plastic duct, and it does a magnificent job. It comes 2-inch width, 4-inch width, and any depth you want. It does a magnificent job, and it's not expensive. Back to you, Dick.
John, give us a description. Is this a spiral-wrapped piece of plastic that takes all the cables out of a rig and binds them together into one composite cable? Is it a tube that all the cables go down? Give us some more words as to what it physically looks like. How do you use it? Where do you buy it? How much does it cost? Over to you, John.
Okay, this is a company that makes a lot of wire management with hooks, but this device I'm talking about, the Panduit, is a trough. It's all plastic, and it has slots on the edge. You mount it to the wall, has a cover that snaps on. You can get it 4x4, 3x6, any configuration you'd like. And you just lay your wires into it, and it has slots on the top that you can bring wires out of or out of the bottom. And it looks so neat, and everything comes out at what looks like right angles. It's perfect for the job.
Okay. Give us the spelling of the name. Hopefully there's a website where we can see a picture of it, and roughly how many dollars. Over to you, John.
Coming.
Panduit, P-A-N-D-U-I-T. They're sold, I even think DigiKey sells it. But any electrical supply house, a major house, would have it probably in stock. And it's like a nylon plastic, and it a couple of small screws will hold it to the wall, and the cover not only snaps on, but you can slide it, you can cut the cover if you'd like and make it two sections so that you can bring wires out of the cover if you need be. Excellent stuff. I cannot recommend it any higher. It's the highest thing. We've used thousands of feet of it on the job, and it's really quick. And when you have to troubleshoot, take the cover off, you can get right into it. No more rat's nest. It's perfect stuff.
Yeah, Wesley had a comment. Go ahead, Wesley.
Interesting. This Panduit is being called also a molding. Now, some of this, they have this double sticky tape, sticky tape. You just sell out that paper that is covered, the molding is covered from that side that's supposed to be sticky to the wall or to the table, behind the table. And also, apart from that, you have any shape of cover that you want, if you want to connect that with any other legs of the structure. So let's say you want to have a key, then you have a key cover of it. So if your cut off is imperfect, let me jump. Then what you do is you put that key cover on it, and it looks magnificent. Now let's say you want to have a Y, or you have a four-way, or three-way. You have a cover, and this cover is a penis. The cost of the molding, about 6 feet long, is about $9. It depends on the size. You can have inch by inch, or you can have inch by half an inch, you can have inch by quarter of inch thick, but that first inch is that surface that is to be sticky to the wall or to the desk, being the desk. Now, if you really want, you can put the screws into it, and then it holds much better. Back to you.
So, there are various ways now of bundling the wiring coming out of a particular rig that you're not moving around and making it look neater. Also, when it comes to the coax cables and maybe some of the B-plus cables, I think there's a lot of advantage of putting labels on the end of the wire, particularly my coax cables that leave the shack and eventually go out to the tower. I like to put labels on the end of each one of those, and there's various ways of doing it. A tie wrap device, there's a tie wrap-like device that has a blade on one end where you can put a label into that blade, into that flat portion, and when you do write down the name of the thing, you got to put some kind of clear tape over it. Particularly if it's outdoors, the ultraviolet will make your ballpoint pen get faded, and eventually it's hard to read. But I'll bet you, Mel, that you've put labels on the end of your coax cables and maybe some of the B plus cables, so that you don't have to keep going to the back of the rig and slowly tracing that particular wire all the way down to the point of interest. By way of the labels on the end of the wire, you know what it is. I wonder if you've done that, Mel. I bet you have. K2KEY, K2RIW in the second net.
KC2QIQ with a comment.
Glenn recognized, but Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, one of the reasons that you develop a rat's nest to begin with is because you can't get behind the equipment. So that's what I have in my shack that was the biggest advance because... yeah, quite held laughing. I've got a lot of equipment, definitely in the shack. And to organize it, keep things neat, I have the consoles are on casters. They have some very neat casters that you can add to desks or get desks that are made for moving. Actually, they are desks that are actually made for being able to be pulled away from the wall. The casters will go over rug, and they have a fairly nice large wheel, and then when you put them in place, they do lock down. And when you can get behind the equipment, that is half the job to organize. Then you can put pan to it, back of the desk area, and then, you know, do it all neat. You can't do it by hanging over, you know, the equipment and trying to do it upside down. Let me drop out, say another word.
Yeah, tell us how you label the end of your wires also, Mel. Go ahead.
K2YL.
Bernie also recognized you're going to be after Glenn. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, found the neatest way to color code the wires. You buy this tape. The tape comes in a, it's used, I don't know where the heck it's used. I don't even remember, I remember buying it. It's four rolls, very narrow tape, and it's a vinyl type tape or a plastic type tape, and it comes in all the colors. The color code. And what you can do, you can start out just by using, you know, black, then use brown, you know, go on to red, orange, you know, stay with the color code basically to start with. And then you can mix to, if you run out of, you know, the single colors, you can put two together then and say, well, this cable is a brown and a red. Color code for 12, number 12 line. So I use that. I find that is permanent and it's easy to identify. It doesn't erase or anything. So my cables all have the taped edges on both ends. I know exactly from them my chart where everything goes thick over.
Hardware store for the tape. Yeah, I think there's sometimes aftermarket for automobiles that use for pinstriping. Hardware stores have got these colored tapes, and I know that a number of commercial tower installations are using stripes of tape around the end of the coax cables, color-coded, and that doesn't fade with ultraviolet exposure. Properly installed, they probably last quite a large number of years, and it doesn't take up any extra volume. So color-coding of the cables, a very smart idea. A number of commercial companies had commercial good tower installations. I've seen that being done. My way of doing it with these tie wrap labels and blades on the end works, sort of, but it's got some disadvantages. Let's see how Glenn solves this problem. KC2QIQ, wait for the beep. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Comment.
Yeah, good evening, Dick, and good evening, everybody on the net tonight. Just a couple of quick comments, actually along the same lines as what Mel was saying. I don't have casters underneath the bottoms of the desk that I'm actually using for my shack, you know, station here in the shack. But one of the things I have done is I've created spacing between the wall and the desk so that I have room to get around back there. Because mainly once the radios are mounted, I've got quite a few here in the shack covering most of the ham bands. And what I've done is I've actually, instead of grouping all of the wires together, what I've done is along the back of the desk, between the wall and the desk, I've actually put little hooks along the back where I can drape the coaxial cables along one line. I let the power lines drape all the way down to the floor very, very neatly where they run out in one direction. And then the speaker wires, I kind of like run them off on one side where I can kind of like very, very neatly drape the wires in a very visible fashion behind the radios so that they don't interfere with each other and tangle. But what really allows me to do that is that once I have the radio placed on the desk, I have that ability to walk around the back and check connections and things like that. So I think that a lot of times just, you know, the placement of the desk in the shack and the ability to get around the back can really be a big help. As far as marking the wires, I do mark quite a few because there's a couple of areas where it gets a little confusing, especially like where the wires come in, you know, through the feed-throughs in the wall and then over the antenna tuners. And what I've found is when I went to Staples, I got those little envelope labels that are maybe about 1 inch wide. They're little peel-offs by about maybe 3.5 to 4 inches long. And you peel them off self-adhesive, mark them, and stick them around the cable stick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Yeah, the peel-off labels are low in volume, easy to install, and you mark them with a ballpoint pen and maybe put a piece of scotch tape, clear tape, over top of them to make sure it doesn't get smeared and lasts a little bit longer. Indoors, that works very well. Outdoors, I find that techniques like that, the ultraviolet exposure, will bleach everything you write there, and it eventually disappears. So the color coding with tape has a lot to go for it. Wesley was recognized, but before him was Bernie. Bernie, how do you solve this problem? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW in the TechNet.
A couple of suggestions, and this comes from 20 years in the telephone and computer wiring business. And this, I'm not going to offer any suggestions for the outdoor stuff. The UV issues, Dick, that you brought up are a different ballgame. Just a couple things to keep in mind. Number one is a device called a P-Touch. It's made by Brother. You find them in an office supply store. It's a label maker. It works wonderful to make a label, wrap it around the wire, attach it to itself so it's like a little flag sticking out. For every test cable I have on my bench, I've P-touched what it is, what the size of the plug is in millimeters, etc. Great for putting a label on those ball warts. So you'll use it for all kinds of stuff in your shop, but it also works wonderful for marking cables. The second thing is a Sharpie. Sharpie is your friend. Sharpie will write on anything. If you have kids, don't let them have one because it writes on anything and doesn't come off. So anything that's nylon, plastic, whatever, a Sharpie will write on it. So you can write on cables, write on telephone jacks, that kind of stuff, or, you know, on your coax is going to be a little harder to write on because it's black and you may not see it. Let me drop for a minute. Mel didn't mention if the original poster was here in the New York metro area. If you are, go to Micro Center out in Woodbury, across from Eisenhower Park. They have a whole aisle of assorted cable management issues stuff. Everything from how to keep those little power adapters from sliding off the desk when they're not plugged into something to major troughing type issues and that kind of thing. So that's a good idea. On my desk, I have a large flat surface, and IKEA makes metal troughs that they're wire troughs that you can see through, and they have fingers so you can run cables in and out of them. And I have those screwed to the back of all of my desk surface so that I can run all my computer, telephone, and radio cables back and forth and all those. So those are just some ideas from the practical industry that might be helpful.
And to APG. Dave recognized, and you're after Wesley. Micro Center in Woodbury, I think you said. Sounds like a good one. IKEA troughs. Now, IKEA, to my knowledge, normally makes a Scandinavian brand furniture. They also have a trough-like device, if it's the IKEA, I-K-E-A, that you're referring to. Give me a little fill on that one, Bernie. Go ahead. And Bernie, when you get a chance, you could use 1 or 2 decibels more audio. Very clean audio, but tiny bit low. K2YO, K2RIW.
Okay, got it on the audio. This poor radio, I think, is headed to radio heaven soon. It is IKEA, the Swedish furniture folks with the good meatballs in the commissary. If you look in their catalog or, at their store, they have a business section for making, a cough button on this radio. If you look in the store, in the section where they have desks, they make desks for businesses, kind of quasi-modular furniture kind of stuff. And in the accessories in that department, they have these wire racks that will let you screw them to the bottom of the desk. They have little toadstools that hold them off the bottom, and it's basically a metal tray, a wire tray that runs along, and you can put whatever in it you want, you know, power cables, whatever kind of cables you need.
Very interesting. I would have never thought to go there. They make some very nice furniture. I think this is the place on Route 106, 107 that you're probably referring to.
Good to know. All righty. The next person with a comment on this was Wesley, N2XJN. Go ahead, Wesley.
It's YYY.
Joe recognized. You're after Dave. Go ahead, Wesley.
N2XJN. Few things. The way that I organize my wires is instead of putting the plastic conduits, I just put the about 15 inches wide piece of wood horizontally next to the wall with a spacing of about 7 inches, and then I put another piece of wood on the top of it, removable. And I put all of the wires inside, and I made just near by the vicinity of that contact between that covering piece of wood and the one that is vertically placed, a hole where the wires goes out, and it looks nice. But I was playing with the labeling for a long period of time, and I have a perfect solution for some people. Let me jump. You can Google right now for Rhino, R-H-I-N-O, 6000, and also known by the name Dymo, D-Y-M-O. This is a beautifully done device. It's a backlit crystal display. It's not expensive. I have two of them. I have 6000, and I believe the other one is 5000. As a matter of fact, I don't need 5000 any longer. Now, this thing will give you VWAP, panel, plug, fixed, muzzle, T-block, vertical, barcode, symbol, and library. Now, the price for the 5000, I believe, is $90 or $90-something. This one is probably about 150. I don't really remember that. You can operate that with the battery, with the rechargeable battery, where you can make it backlit. If it's dark, you don't have to do it. The battery holds for quite a few months, and it does have a mechanical or motorized cut feed, so you press the print, and then you print at whatever size you want and how big the label is supposed to be. And you can cut it goes automatically, ready to use, and it's a double sticky tape. Now, the tape could be made from either plastic, either a special a silk material, or many other ways, and it's very much inexpensive. As a matter of fact, I'm holding one in my hand. Then you can connect that to the computer through the USB cable or fast a USB, which is a little bit bigger plug. You can have also external power supply if you want to, and it does have a hook to hook it on the wall or the belt if you want to carry on that, and it's made with a thick rubber around, so if it drops, nothing is going to happen to that. So that's my comment. Back to you, and to you.
And WS2N.
Paul recognized, and hereafter Dave and Joe in that order. Thank you for that information, Wesley. Dave, N2APG, how do you solve the problem? You got it, Dave.
Yeah, hi, Dick, N2APG. I just wanted to mention real quick something that Bernie mentioned, the Sharpie markers. I think everybody's familiar, you know, with the black ones and the red ones and the blue ones and things like that, but they also make what they call a metallic line. I believe it comes in gold and silver, and it's very, very nice. You can write on wall warts, you know, the hard plastic. You can use it to, you know, label steel cables, things like that. It's indelible. The silver shows up really nicely. And, you know, a quick and easy way to label hard plastic things. That's the Sharpie metallic markers take over.
On a quick break, Dave, where's your favorite place to buy those particular Sharpies? Staples? Over to you, Dave.
Yeah, I think just about every place that sells, you know, the regular Sharpie markers, stationery stores, Staples, things like that. has them. You can also get them, online, eBay, things like that.
Okay, very good. Joe, you're next. W-H-R-Y-Y. I wonder how you solved this problem. K-2-R-I-W in the TechNet. You got it, Joe.
I'm signing in to be able to ask you another completely different question on a completely different subject, so just put me on the list.
Okay, you're on the list right now, right after Rich. Paul, WS2N, how have you solved the problem? Those guys out there in Ronkonkoma like to lay out their rigs real neat, I bet. You got it, Paul.
Mine is neat. There's no question about it. You have sometimes an area where you don't have much room. You don't want to leave your desk too far away from the wall to get behind there to work, so you want to be able to pull your desk in and out. I got these things, well, originally they were marketed, they were called moving men, but now they're under all kinds of different names. And they're these plastic things with this foam top to it, and you put them under desks. My desk, it's got to weigh, with all the equipment, I guess probably 200 pounds. And I just took four of these things and leave them under the desk on a rug, especially, if you have a room with a rug. I can push this desk back and forth almost like it's on wheels. So you might remember the original commercials. They used to put them on under the tires of a car in a showroom and push the car. But, of course, that was to the extreme. These things are about, maybe 3 inches in diameter, the ones that I use, and you can get them real cheap. I think these came out of Walgreens, a pack for a dollar or something. They were all over everywhere now. So that's what I use for moving the desk back and forth to get to the wires.
Now, it's not quite clear to me. This 3-inch diameter object called moving men, is it a pivotable wheel, or is it a slippery sliding substance that goes on the rug and on the leg of the table? I'm not quite sure what it is. Give me a few more words on that, and roughly how many dollars and where you buy it. WS2N, K2RIW in the Tech Man.
They probably came out 20, 25 years ago, like for $10, they were high priced. But then, as time went on, all kinds of other companies make them. So you could buy them with different diameters. I got the ones about 3 inches in diameter. And a pack of four was like $1, ridiculously low price. And, it's just a... figure a three inch disc, very very smooth on a bottom, a plastic disc, and on the top of the disc it's got this like foam base to it, very thick foam. So you put it under a desk, or in my case, and the desk like crushes into the foam, but this it's plastic, a couple of, it's like a parabolic shape underneath. It'll slide. It's a big fancy coaster.
Sounds like a very nice way to go. Okay, I think I've gone down the list of everyone who signed in. Looks like we've got various ways of moving the desk to get behind, various ways of bundling the cables, labeling the cables. So it looks like you got to put some work and some forethought into it. But eventually we're going to keep our rigs neat looking in the back. It says here, one of these days I've got to start doing this. Over you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick and Tulio.
You had a further comment, Rich?
Yeah, I just Googled Panduit. They have a website, panduit.com, and they have a locator with a map. You can go in there and see where the local distributor is. They have, what John said, and they got tons more stuff. They got plenty of stuff, and it's all available locally in Great Neck, Woodside, Bayside, everywhere.
Good to know. Panduit.com. Okay. Looks like we're going to become more organized, Mel. One of these days, we've got to get organized. K2KUI, K2RIW.
Yes, definitely. Yeah, the bottom line is very good ideas on how to get behind it, either putting wheels or those slip joints flip the gadgets that Paul had mentioned. I've seen them now. I remember them. They go on the bottom legs of desks so that you can easily pull it even on rugs and move it away from the wall. And then, of course, a lot of ways to organize with Pandora ties and things like that, and marking methods. And that's the bottom line. And, well, Glenn had a very good idea to keep it away. Well, if you're a skinny guy like him, like I am, we could easily slip behind, you know, the if it's only a short distance from the wall. Okay, very good. One more, Dick?
Go for it, Mel.
Okay, let's see. Here's one. The last ham fest in Timonium, Maryland. Oh, yeah. That's quite a ham fest. A number of people that have attended that. I picked up a meter, and the meter says 50 ADC. However, in the corner, in the bottom of the meter, it says SS equals 50 MV. What does this all mean? Okay, you want to explain why they marked it 50 amperes DC on the main scale, but in the corner it's marked 50 MV. Dick, go ahead.
There's two ways of measuring current flowing down a wire. One way is to know that by Lenz's law or Faraday's law, X number of electrons moving past a certain point at a certain period of time create a magnetic field. So magnetic pickup devices can measure current, and they're the nicest because they don't interfere with the wiring. There's something external, and as long as it's DC current flowing, they give you a beautiful indication. Clip-on type ammeters do this, and there's kinds of scope probes that do it. That's one way of measuring current. Another way of measuring current is to put a device in series with the wire. And now that device, I'm looking at one that I've got in my hand right now. This particular one I've got, that's a 5 ampere job. I've got another one that's rated for, I think it's 50 or 500 amperes. I think it's 50 amperes. Anyhow, what this device looks like is it's got a very wide piece of copper strip in between two humongous connectors, and it has a known number of ohms across this wide piece of copper. They've carefully notched it in such a way that they know exactly how many ohms it's got. So my particular 50-amp device, the actual number of ohms between these two humongous connectors is 1 milliohm, 1,000th of an ohm. So for each ampere that flows, a millivolt by ohm square, by Ohm's law, will be dropped across the device. So when I'm doing a 50 ampere measurement with my device that has a series resistance of 1 milliohm, there will be 50 millivolts of drop. So I put my digital voltmeter across this device, measure millivolts. Each millivolt equals some number of amperes flowing through that device because it has a very precisely known number of ohms. That's the good news. Let me drop. But you'll notice that in order for me to measure 50 amperes with my 1 milliohm device, 50 millivolts must be dropped across it. That's Ohm's law. If I'm running a circuit that happens to be an extremely low voltage circuit, which the whole darn circuit runs on 200 millivolts in my ridiculous example, and I'm wasting 50 millivolts of that 200 millivolts just in order to measure the current, that might not be so tolerable. So that meter movement that the writer is telling you about, Mel, as I see it, is telling you that particular device is made for a 50-ampere measurement, but it will give you an impact of 50 millivolts when you measure 50 amps. By the same token, when you put a fuse into a circuit, various brands, if you go to the right data sheet, let me drop. Every fuse you have ever used creates a finite amount of voltage drop. I can go out and buy 3AG fuses. That's a little cartridge fuse of a particular size called 3AG. I can buy a 3AG fuse rated for 5 amperes. And one style says good for 250 volts. Another style says good for 15 volts. And you'll say, what in the world's the difference? 5 amperes is 5 amperes. It's a 5-amp fuse. Well, they've done something different in the design of the 5-volt fuse, or the 12-volt fuse, so that there's a smaller number of volts of drop across the fuse when it's in operation. But every fuse has a certain amount of volts drop, and you have to learn to live with that. And so if you just willy-nilly adding a fuse to a particular circuit and you use the wrong kind of fuse, the voltage drop across the fuse or the voltage drop across your ampere measuring device could be creating an impact on your circuit that you'd like to know about. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Yeah, definitely, because I had an experience with a Citizen 260 meter where the fuse went bad. You know, in the late model ones, they stuck a fuse in there. And 3AG type fuse, and I said, ah, big deal, take another fuse in. Well, I stuck it in, meter works, but the R times one scale won't go to full scale. And I'm saying, ah, the battery, the D battery is most likely gone. I put a new D battery in, still won't go to full scale. I'm start looking around in this meter, and for some reason I said, it worked. Until what? Until that fuse opened up. And I said to myself, just as you said, you can't just put a fuse in. I jumped the fuse momentarily, and the meter went over full scale on the R times one scale. So, there are fuses, and there are fuses. Okay, let me say a few words about the meter. 50 amps DC, it says on the scale, and in the corner it says FF equals 50 MV. This would mean that it's a 50 millivolt type movement. In other words, full scale is 50 millivolts, or translated simply would be 0.05 volts. And what you had most likely in a piece of equipment, let it drop. What you had in a piece of equipment, as Dick says, you had a thing called a shunt, S-H-U-N-T. And that's known as an external shunt because that kind of current, I doubt if they would stick it inside the meter. So they had on in the panel, wherever the piece of this meter came out of, there was a shunt. And that's how they were able to measure with that shunt. As Dick says, we were able to get 50 amperes full scale. So, without the shunt, if you, of course, want to go figuring that out, there's a way of figuring out, you know, what you need to do it quickly. I'll just tell you that A would be equal, amperes would be equal to about 0.001 ohm for if you were going to use it back in a 50 amp meter, but I guess you won't be interested in that, so it now is a 50 millivolt meter or 0.05 volts for full scale. I think I said it right, Dick. Go ahead.
Yes, you did. And once you've got that shunting device, the device that's got the 0.001 ohm, 1 milliohm of resistance with great big connectors on it, and it's going to give you at 50 amperes of flow through it by Ohm's law, 50 millivolts of drop. The nice thing about that is you can hide that behind the front panel, you can hide it in the cabling, you can put it anywhere you want. And then you run two ordinary diameter pieces of wire that are good for milliamps of current flow, and you run those two wires from the shunting device over to your meter, and the meter in some cases could be 10 feet away because very little current is flowing through those wires to the meter movement, and maybe the meter movement is one that only requires some number of microamperes of current flow, so that you can do an awful lot of remote sensing of high current with that kind of a device. It really is a Kelvin connection ohmmeter. It's a four-leaded ohmmeter. The two main great big connectors have the 50 amps flowing through it. The other two connectors have the sampling voltage and a minor amount of current flowing through those much smaller gauge wire over to your meter, and the meter could be, as I said, 10 feet away, and it still have pretty darn good calibration. And there's ways of even correcting for the tiny amount of voltage drop in that 10 feet of wiring in my example. There's ways of correcting for that. So remote sensing of current. Magnetic is one way, and voltage drop is another. And you can buy surface mount resistors, 12.06 type or whatever, which have
milliohms of resistance where you can put them throughout your printed circuit board and be able to measure current that flows in various portions of your circuit with a very compact looking device. And some of these properly done can operate at rather high frequencies and measure current. Why don't you go to another one, Mel?
T2L?
Go ahead, Bernie.
JC.
I heard JC, but Bernie first. Go ahead, Bernie.
Dick, before you move on, could you touch on just a moment, how does a four-wire Kelvin voltmeter work? What do the four wires do versus, obviously in a two-wire, you've got a simple circuit there, but what do the extra pair of wires do on a Kelvin meter?
Okay. See if I can explain this one now. Under normal circumstances, if I wanted to measure a circuit, I've got a black box, and inside that black box, someone told me it is 0.500 ohms of resistance. It's a precision resistor inside of a black box, and the resistance is one-half of 1 ohm, 0.500 ohms. 0.500 ohms, and I want to confirm that. I'm the calibration laboratory. Common sense would lead you to believe I pick up my well-calibrated digital voltmeter, go over to the ohm meter scale, connect my ohm meter across those two terminals, and if I'll do that, I'll probably measure 1.01 ohms. And I'll say to myself, whoa, wait a minute now. This thing is, it's got a great big label on the front panel. It says it's traceable to the National Bureau of Standards. It says it's 0.500 ohms. I put my ohm meter leads on there very carefully, and I measured 1.1 ohms. The first time I measured it, I disconnect, I connect it again, and I measure 1.015. I disconnect, I connect again, I measure 1.002, and I say, what the hell is going on here? You suddenly realize that when you put the two probes of an ohm meter across the circuit, the contact resistance of your ohm meter probes in some cases have a good fraction of an ohm of resistance, just the probes themselves making contact. So you think you're measuring the number of ohms inside the box. You're not. You're measuring the combination of the ohms in the box plus the contact resistance of your probes, and in the worst case, the extra leads that go into your digital voltmeter, they're also adding some extra resistance. Think.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Then you decide to get smart. You pick up this device that's called a Kelvin connection testing device. It's a precision device. It's got great big connectors on one end. Maybe it's a quarter 20 volt, or maybe it's a 16 volt or whatever on each end of this great big device. And marked onto its front panel is the resistance, and maybe it's 1 milliohm, 0.0001 ohm. And how in the world can I use that to confirm what's inside the box? And the answer is, you connect this to one of those leads. The other lead, you connect to a power supply. So one of the leads of the black box is going to a power supply. The other lead is going to this Kelvin device. The remaining lead of the Kelvin device goes back to the power supply. I set up the power supply into the constant current mode, and I set it for 1 ampere of current flow. I now know, because it's a simple series circuit, and everything in the series circuit sees the exact same current. The power supply, the Kelvin device, and the thing that's inside the black box. Everything has exactly 1 ampere flowing. I confirm that by putting my ohm meter across the Kelvin device, the four-leaded device, and because 1 ampere is flowing, and it is traceable to the bureau, and it says it's got 1 milliohm of resistance, my digital voltmeter there is going to say exactly 1 millivolt is flowing, is the voltage drop across the Kelvin device. In other words, the two big leads are conducting to 1 ampere. The two little bitty leads are going over to my digital voltmeter. I measured 1 millivolt, and I now know, because the device inside is made for exactly 1 milliohm, I know I've now got confirmation that exactly 1 ampere is flowing. The meter on the front of my power supply says 1 ampere.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
My power supply meter says 1 ampere. My digital voltmeter across the two, lead number 3 and lead number 4 of the Kelvin device says 1 millivolt. That's another confirmation of 1 ampere. I now know 1 ampere is flowing through everything in that circuit.
I now put my digital voltmeter across the black box. And my digital voltmeter doesn't disturb it because it's got a 10 megohm impedance. I'm putting 10 megohms across a half ohm resistor, which is, you know, one part per million type stuff, not to worry about it. I'm not disturbing the sensitivity, not disturbing the accuracy. And now if what's inside that black box is exactly 0.500 ohms, I will measure exactly 0.500 volts. So that Kelvin device has given me a way of measuring precise current and in some cases measuring precise resistance without the contact resistance of normal connections giving me an error function. Wonder if you can see that picture, K2YO, you got it, Bernie, K2RIW.
KC2QIQ with a clarification.
Bernie first, go ahead, Bernie.
Yes, affirmative. So basically the extra two leads are just giving me a higher precision and letting me isolate out my measuring artifacts, for lack of a better word. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, lead number three and lead number four of the four-leaded device, the Kelvin connection device, goes to a very precise position inside of that 1 milliohm, great big wide chunk of copper that's inside of this device. And now the contact resistance that I get on the two big bolts on the end no longer matters because I'm using it in a constant current circuit, and I've defined everything in that current loop. And now by measuring precision millivolts in various places, I know exactly how much current is flowing. I know exactly how many ohms is in the black box. Let's see how Glenn has used this. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think you did an excellent job of describing it there, Dick, quite eloquently. It's just that I kind of wanted to give a very, very simpler explanation for what the Kelvin lead is kind of doing. And that basically, as you were explaining, that, you know, that there is, you know, you get the precision resistance right across the Kelvin leads. But what's really going on there is that Kelvin, the Kelvin connection, is basically a very, very low to no current. Actually, there's going to be some light current in the Kelvin connection, but it's very, very light. And the high currents that's being used to actually measure the drop across the resistor is going through the two main leads. So basically what you're doing is you're measuring open circuit resistance, or the voltage, the open circuit voltage across the Kelvin lead. So it's the order of current magnitude that's different between the outside leads to the inside lead. Because basically if you take any stray resistances, if there's no current in them or in those impedances, then there's virtually no voltage drop across the Kelvin connections. So all the voltage drop is really taken across the two outside leads, and the precision measurements being taken across the two inside with no current in them or very, very light current stick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
In my example of that use of the Kelvin device, lead number three and lead number four, the light current leads, are going to my digital voltmeter. If I'm using a reasonable quality modern-day digital voltmeter, it has an internal impedance of 10 million ohms, 10 megohms. And yet it's going across those two leads coming out of the Kelvin device where the internal precision resistor, in my example, is 1 milliohm. So if I put 10 megohms across 1 milliohm, I think I get one part per billion accuracy out of that, as long as I've got reasonable resistance of that wiring. Very little current is flowing through those lead number three and lead number four, where I can have 1,000 amperes flowing through the great big leads on this Kelvin device, lead number one and lead number two. And the contact resistance of those leads is less relevant if I put them into a constant current circuit for the measurement. And I confirm that the right amount of current is flowing because on the lead number three and lead number four, I see exactly 50 millivolts if I wanted to put 50 amperes through there, and by also putting my oscilloscope there and seeing if the oscilloscope is giving me a nice flat line with no noise, I know that I don't have any noisy connections anywhere, and my constant current power supply isn't doing anything funny. There are operational amplifier circuits. For instance, the one that feeds the magnetizing coil of a Yig filter or a Yig oscillator. Let me drop. The beauty of a Yig oscillator or a Yig filter is that there is a one-to-one relationship, a linear relationship, between the exact number of milliamperes you put through the magnetizing coil and the exact frequency that that filter or oscillator is on. YIG is a beautiful linear device. You can get the, you know, one megacycle of error out of 12,000 megacycles if you buy a good one. So for every milliampere that flows through that magnetizing coil of a YIG filter or a YIG oscillator, I know exactly what center frequency that thing is on. And I've used that in spectrum analyzers that use the YIG filter and a YIG oscillator as the mixer front end. But there's a catch. As you put the voltage or current through that magnetizing coil, the coil heats up. The internal resistance of the coil changes, and the oscillator drifts. Unless you're smart enough to build a constant current circuit, not a constant voltage circuit, to put the power into that magnetizing coil. So if you're smart enough to build the right kind of an operational amplifier circuit, which is a sampling resistor with Kelvin connections, and you don't have to buy a Kelvin connection resistor. You just use your ordinary half-ampere sampling resistor, hopefully it's a precision one, and you put two extra leads on it going over to your voltage sensing circuit of your operational amplifier network, and it keeps that voltage drop across your precision half-ohm resistor, keeps that voltage constant drop. Now you know exactly what current is flowing through your circuit. You know exactly what current is flowing through your magnetizing coil, even though the coil is heating up and its resistance is increasing and the voltage drop across the coil is increasing. You keep the current constant. You've made a very precise amount of magnetic field internally. The YIG device, whether it be an oscillator or filter, is...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The YIG device or the YIG filter is now on an exactly predictable frequency, and it's a beautiful thing. And now when it comes to the tracking alignment of a swept spectrum analyzer that has a YIG filter in the front end to make sure it doesn't have any spurious responses, some in different frequencies and intermodulation distortion and whatever, whether or not as you sweep across the band at 30 times per second, you might be sweeping from 4 to 8 gigahertz, you want that filter that's 30 megacycles wide to sweep exactly megacycle per megacycle with the sweeping oscillator that's sweeping from roughly 4 to 8 gigahertz with maybe a 200 meg first IF frequency. 250 megs might be a typical number. And so you want the two to track each other. And as long as those two YIG-tuned circuits, one's a filter, one's a YIG-tuned oscillator, as long as they track each other with precision by way of constant current generating circuits, the thing starts off when it's cold, it's beautifully tracked, and when it's hot, it's tracked, and a year later, it's tracked with one catch. You ship that spectrum analyzer in an airline where the spectrum analyzer is in the cargo hold and it's being bathed in 5,000 cycle high amplitude noise from those engines, and the individual shells of the YIG filter and the YIG oscillator are now vibrating with each other, and they start settling into a slightly different position. Your YIG filter or YIG oscillator may have a brand new tuning curve that's very similar, but a little bit different. Once you've shipped your spectrum analyzer with this tracking filter, you better have your representative on the other end of the country do a double check to make sure that everything is still tracked once it's through with that airline shipment. Or you better pack it very well with good foam and good soundproofing to stop that phenomenon from happening. And if you have any questions on this constant current generating circuits, Kelvin connections and whatever, give me your call letters right now. K2RIWM and TechNet.
K2KEY, want to finish the subject.
Yeah, Mel recognized. Go ahead, Mel, finish the subject. I guess we did get a little off-center.
I think it definitely. Long, long, long ago, I remember in school, in tech, in the lab there, something very interesting that came to mind with shunts, meters and shunts. And I saw something there that reminded me to this day, and I was wondering. It puzzled me, even though, you know, I never really pursued it, but I think it's correct. They were making shunts number 16 gauge copper wire, because number 16 gauge copper wire, every 3 inches of number 16 gauge copper wire has a resistance of 0.001 ohms. And that's how they made shunts. They'd coil up appropriate lengths of number 16, of a piece of 16, and using 001 ohms every 3 inch as a shunt.